The Federal News Update for Tuesday, December 23rd, 2025. Welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Alex Johnson.
And I'm Sam Kennedy, your investigative expert on federal machinery.
And what a day of machinery to investigate. We are looking at an incredibly dense stack of material.
It really is. It feels like we're diving into a compressed timeline of just extraordinary governmental activity. We're focused on Monday, December 22nd, a day that, well, it wasn't just busy. It feels like it actively redefined the operational boundaries of the executive branch.
That's absolutely the right way to put it. When you and I were going through the sources, it felt less like a news cycle and more like the full activation of a doctrine.
Exactly.
The consensus from everything we've analyzed is that this date, December 22nd, 2025, it marks a true watershed moment. It's defining this administration's accelerated policy doctrine, and it was implemented with, well, with maximalist intent. It was the day the government really put the pedal to the floor.
And that maximalist intent, that gives us our mission for this deep dive.
Mm-hmm.
We are conducting an exhaustive, really granular examination of simultaneous actions that happened across all three branches, executive, legislative, and judicial.
We're not just here to summarize the headlines.
No, not at all. We are connecting the dots. We're going from, say, the reintroduction of tactical nuclear weapons at sea all the way to the functional collapse of the federal retirement system. We have to focus on the immediate operational impact and, just as crucially, the long-term systemic implications these moves have for you, the listener, as you navigate this new reality.
And there's a theme, isn't there? A dominant, unifying theme that emerged from all of this.
There is. It's the definitive operationalization of what the sources are describing as a muscular, centralized, and technologically aggressive apparatus.
I think we need to test that frame right away. If this apparatus is so centralized and technologically aggressive, where are we seeing the immediate pain points?
Good question.
To make any sense of the sheer volume of these high-stakes policy reversals, all in a single 24-hour period, we've had to group them. We're looking at four primary interconnected theaters of action: defense transformation, immigration acceleration, energy realignment, and finally, constitutional litigation.
A lot to unpack.
A huge amount. So, okay, let's dive right into the most visible, maybe the most consequential of those theaters: the shift in kinetic power, what we're calling the militarization of power.
And if you really want to understand the new ethos, this centralizing philosophy of the administration, you absolutely have to start with the military. The symbolic and material reversion of defense strategy has been the most dramatic move. It really sets the tone for everything else.
And the first thing that jumps out at any reader, any observer, is it's the language shift. We saw the formal transition, rhetorically speaking, from the Department of Defense to the Department of War.
That name change is.
Oh.
It's pure, unadulterated rhetoric, but with a profound cultural purpose. Yeah, to be clear, this was technically authorized by an executive order, 14347, back in September of 2025.
Right, so this isn't brand new, but the usage is.
Exactly. Congress still holds the statutory name of Department of Defense. The law hasn't changed, but the branding has. The consistent use of the title Secretary of War Pete Hegseth on December 22nd that underscored this institutional shift.
And the goal is what?
The entire goal is to align the military ethos purely with warfighting and victory. It's about stripping away those peacekeeping and nation-building connotations that have really defined the military since the post-World War II era. It's a cultural reclamation, and is part of a much broader trend we're seeing, a sort of nationalist reclamation of nomenclature across the executive branch.
And this rhetorical shift was given immediate, very material weight, wasn't it, at the Mar-a-Lago Security Summit on December 22nd?
Or absolutely. This wasn't just some cabinet briefing. It was explicitly framed as a war cabinet launchpad.
He was in the room.
The attendees were very strategically chosen. You had Secretary of State Marco Rubio, Secretary of War Pete Hegseth, and the Secretary of the Navy, John Thielen. And while, you know, the official reason was to discuss escalating tensions in the Caribbean, it really served as the platform for unveiling the Golden Fleet Doctrine.
Okay, let's get granular on that centerpiece, because this represents an absolutely decisive break from naval doctrine that's been in place for decades. We've favored smaller, distributed, less concentrated vessels.
And this is the opposite.
Completely. They announced the Trump-class battleship with the lead vessel designated the USS Defiant, BBG-1.
And the specifications here are, well, they're shocking. They tell the story of a massive strategic gamble, one that's designed to project overwhelming power.
Talk us through the size.
The projected displacement is somewhere between 30,000 and 40,000 tons. Now, to give you some scale, that puts its length at around 880 feet. This is a true capital ship. It's designed to be physically imposing and, frankly, technologically terrifying. And that immense tonnage isn't just for show. It's necessary to house the massive power generation systems you need to run its primary armament.
Which is?
Railguns and hypersonic IRCPS.
Okay, we need to stop there for a moment. For the learner, what are hypersonic IRCPS and why do they demand that kind of tonnage?
Right, so IRCPS stands for the Integrated Rocket Cruising Projectile System. These are next-generation missiles. They fly at Mach 5 or higher, which makes them virtually indefensible once they're launched.
And the power needed for that?
The power needed to fire those railguns and to run these advanced directed energy weapons, the high-energy lasers that form its defense system, it requires a dedicated, incredibly high-output power source. The sources we've looked at strongly imply a nuclear propulsion architecture.
So like an aircraft carrier.
Very similar to the Ford-class carriers. You need that for the unlimited range and power dominance the administration keeps talking about. You simply cannot generate the necessary megawatts to fire a railgun repeatedly or maintain a high-energy laser defense shield using conventional gas turbines. It's just not possible.
And that laser defense shield, that's the key to the whole strategy, isn't it? The high-energy lasers combined with these Block 3 SUAP systems.
It absolutely is. Block 3 SUAP is the most advanced electronic warfare suite the Navy has. And that technological shield is the administration's direct counter to what's known as the eggshell theory.
Explain that for us.
Well, critics, especially naval analysts, they point out that concentrating this much offensive power into a few massive hulls makes the fleet incredibly vulnerable. You could face a saturation attack using modern, relatively inexpensive anti-ship ballistic missiles, like the Chinese DF-21D or the DF-26.
So you're putting all your eggs in one very expensive, very large basket.
Exactly. The administration is gambling everything on this impenetrable laser defense shield to negate that threat. It's a strategy that prioritizes overwhelming offensive capability over the survivability and redundancy you get with a fleet of smaller ships.
But the truly profound strategic shift here, the one that I think fundamentally rewrites the international nuclear playbook, is the confirmation that these ships will carry nuclear-armed, sea-launched cruise missiles.
That is the crucial history-altering detail. It can't be overstated. Ever since the presidential nuclear initiatives of the early 1990s, the U.S. Navy has strictly prohibited tactical nuclear weapons on its surface ships.
And now they're back.
And reintroducing them complicates the entire escalation ladder in any theater, but especially in the Pacific or the Caribbean. Now, any adversary who engages a Trump-class battleship has to treat it not just as a conventional warship,
but as a potential strategic threat.
A strategic threat capable of launching a first-strike nuclear weapon. This profoundly changes the calculus of naval engagements and diplomatic signaling.
But if this fleet is such a massive technological gamble, I have to ask, is the economic goal the real driver here? Creating political dependency across key manufacturing states, making the national security argument almost secondary.
It's a very astute question. The sources we have frame this Golden Fleet initiative, which includes the battleships and up to 50 support ships, as a colossal strategic economic play.
How so?
The goal is overtly political. It's to pump hundreds of billions of dollars into heavy manufacturing. And they're intentionally engaging shipyards from Philadelphia to San Diego, from Maine to Mississippi. That's a direct quote.
So you're locking in political support.
You're creating a powerful political constituency that becomes dependent on the program's continuation. That makes it extremely difficult for any future administration, Democrat or Republican, to cancel it. The market reaction confirmed this immediately.
What did we see in the stocks?
Huntington Ingalls Industries, HII. Their shares surged 4.3% to a record high. General Dynamics, GD, also saw an immediate positive jump, anticipating contracts for the nuclear propulsion systems through its electric boat division. This is defense policy as infrastructure spending.
So we have the material, the rhetoric, and the economics all aligned. How did this new Department of War ethos immediately translate into kinetic action abroad in the 24 hours surrounding this big announcement?
We saw the practical application almost instantly in the intensified Venezuela blockade. The U.S. Coast Guard, which is now operating under broadened and intensified rules of engagement, went after a second tanker, the Bella One, on December 22nd.
And that came just after they seized another ship, right?
Right, the Panama Flag Centuries, which was seized just 2 days earlier on December 20th.
The administration officially frames this as a blockade against narcotics and sanctioned oil. But what is the true endgame here? Is it drugs? Is it oil? Or is it really regime change?
Analysts are debating this intensely. President Trump confirmed the U.S. is keeping both the seized oil and the ships themselves.
Which complicates the narrative.
It does. While the administration points to the designation of fentanyl as a weapon of mass destruction, or WMD via Executive Order 14367, and that unlocks counterterrorism authorities for the War Department and DHS to target cartels, the geopolitical endgame is clearly Caracas.
So this is about pressure.
Massive pressure. General Wesley Clark warned that keeping the oil makes the U.S. look like, quote, greedy North Americanos, just going after resources, and that complicates the diplomatic justification. But the most critical indicator of high risk came from Russia.
What did Moscow do?
The Russian Foreign Ministry began evacuating diplomatic families from Caracas. That suggests that Moscow assesses the risk of U.S. military action or even imminent regime collapse as extremely high. And the coercive diplomacy is backed by massive force. We're talking 15% of the entire U.S. Navy strike capability. 15 to 20,000 sailors and Marines are currently in the Caribbean.
And while all the focus is on that kinetic force, we also saw an acceleration in Arctic ambitions, specifically Greenland, signaling a longer-term strategic interest.
Absolutely. The appointment of Jeff Landry, the governor of Louisiana, as special envoy to Greenland, confirms this focus on natural resources and strategic positioning. He wasted no time at all.
What was his first move?
He publicly claimed the goal is to make Greenland part of the U.S., citing national security interests tied to Russia's growing presence in the Arctic.
And the diplomatic fallout from that was immediate, I assume, straining relations with key NATO allies.
Instant and strong condemnation. Denmark and Greenland immediately pushed back, and the EU, through Ursula von der Leyen, expressed solidarity with their NATO ally, calling the move inappropriate.
But the administration is pressing ahead.
Yes, they're prioritizing strategic interests, which seem to be driven by security concerns raised by Vice President J.D. Vance about Denmark's perceived underinvestment in the island's security architecture. They're prioritizing that over diplomatic norms, and they seem to be accepting the short-term strain as a necessary cost.
Okay, that sets the stage for a centralized, militarized foreign policy backed by overwhelming hard power. But that centralization isn't limited to hardware. It extends deeply into the digital and regulatory spheres. I want to shift gears completely now and examine the second major theater, the technocratic state. This is where we see the administration actively sweeping aside environmental and consumer protections in the name of technological supremacy.
And what we're observing here is the systematic dismantling of regulatory barriers whenever they conflict with industrial growth or national security. It's all explicitly tied to this ambition of achieving technological hegemony over geopolitical rivals. And this entire push is contextualized by something called the Genesis Mission.
Let's start with the AI dominance doctrine, which was exemplified by that stunning regulatory reversal from the FTC on December 22nd.
The Federal Trade Commission, under its new administration-aligned leadership, vacated a major 2024 final consent order against a company called RITR LLC.
Remind our listeners what RITR does.
RITR is an AI writing tool. It was previously sanctioned because this technology could be easily used to generate vast quantities of fake consumer reviews, which, you know, effectively pollutes the marketplace and misleads buyers.
So why the complete 180 less than a year later?
The commission's new ruling stated that the original 2024 order had, quote, unduly burdened AI innovation. The new standard now requires demonstrating actual consumer harm. This aligns perfectly with the administration's push for what they call permissionless innovation.
Which means what exactly?
The doctrine is essentially that technology cannot be preemptively banned or restricted just because it can be misused. You have to demonstrate damage after the fact. It clears the deck for maximal experimentation, and it accepts the social risks that are inherent in generative AI, from fake reviews to deepfakes, as the necessary cost to maintain that geopolitical technological superiority.
And this leads directly back to the Genesis mission. What is that mission, and how does it drive this AI push?
The Genesis mission is an executive order from earlier in December of 2025. It directs the Department of Energy to leverage its national lab supercomputers to build a closed-loop AI experimentation platform.
For what purpose?
The objective is extremely ambitious. Rapid, accelerated scientific discovery in critical fields like nuclear fusion, advanced biotechnology, and material science. The goal is to compress decades of research into just a few years, securing technological hegemony over rivals like China and Russia. This mission is the explicit foundation that justifies the FTC's new deregulatory stance.
It's a fascinating contradiction, though. Even as the U.S. pushes for this technological supremacy, the administration simultaneously approved the sale of 80,000 H200 AI chips, which are NVIDIA's second most powerful chips to China. Shipments are planned for mid-February. How do you reconcile selling cutting-edge tech to your primary rival while you're aiming for hegemony?
Well, analysts like Dan Ives view this as a hard economic reality that's tempering the national security idealism.
So it's about the money.
It's about maintaining the lead. NVIDIA is the undisputed global leader. To maintain the domestic industry's financial engine and its R&D lead, you have to give them access to the Chinese market, which is worth billions in revenue. If you cut them off entirely, you create a massive incentive for domestic Chinese competition, like Huawei, to accelerate their own technology development and narrow the gap. It's a risky economic balance.
So it's controlled access to fund innovation rather than total prohibition, which might risk creating a viable rival ecosystem.
Exactly. It's a very fine line to walk.
Let's pivot to the energy realignment theater, where national security was leveraged to directly hobble the clean energy sector. This was the major move by the Department of the Interior on December 22nd.
It was an immediate and very severe action. The DOI suspended the leases for five major Atlantic offshore wind projects. We're talking about Vineyard Wind 1, Revolution Wind, CVOW, Sunrise Wind, and Empire Wind 1.
These are huge projects.
Huge. Collectively, they represent the capacity to power over 2.5 million homes and billions of dollars in investment.
And the justification wasn't environmental impact or, you know, the typical economic feasibility studies. It was pure national security, citing classified reports from the newly established Department of War.
Yes, the radar clutter justification. The administration is arguing that the massive towers and the continuously rotating blades create interference patterns that degrade the fidelity of our coastal early warning radar system.
And that degradation matters because...
They claim it's critical for detecting modern threats, specifically things like low-flying cruise missiles or hypersonic glide vehicles from peer competitors. The operational trade-off is clear. If you adjust your radar sensitivity to filter out the turbine interference, you risk missing small, fast-moving actual targets. The official stance is that for national defense, that trade-off is simply unacceptable. Hence, an immediate moratorium.
But this justification drew immediate political fire, didn't it? Is there a risk that this national security rationale is just a convenient cover for ideological opposition to large-scale green energy?
That is the essential question being asked by the political opposition. Virginia Senators Warner and Kaine, both of whom sit on key intelligence committees, they publicly claimed they saw no justifying intelligence that would warrant a total immediate halt.
So they're calling it a pretext.
They characterized the move as ideological opposition disguised as national security necessity. But regardless of the underlying motives, the financial fallout was immediate and severe. It just demonstrates the vulnerability of this sector to sudden executive action.
How bad was it?
Oryx shares plummeted 13%. Dominion Energy, which is tied to the now-threatened $10 billion CVOW project, fell 5.4%. And Vestas, a major turbine manufacturer, dropped 6%. This one announcement wiped billions off the global market in a single day.
Let's move from physical security to digital security, cyber defense. The federal machinery is rolling out massive compliance mandates, despite what seems to be widespread contractor and agency concerns.
We're talking about the Cybersecurity Maturity Model Certification, or CMMC. Level 2, which governs what's called controlled unclassified information, or CUI, that's sensitive data that isn't classified but still has to be protected, is now officially in effect for contractors as of November 10th.
So this means CMMC Level 2 requirements can now be explicitly written into new Department of Defense solicitations.
Correct. It's live.
Now, for the listener who might be a contractor, where is the immediate compliance pain point? I was surprised to see it isn't level 2, but actually the seemingly easier level 1.
That's the subtlety that many people missed. Level 1 governs federal contract information, or FCI, which is basic information provided by the government for contract performance. The problem is that FCI is usually unmarked 99% of the time.
So you don't even know you have it.
It makes identification and tracking incredibly difficult. Level 1 requires a self-assessment and an annual affirmation against some basic security controls, which most companies thought they already had in place. But proving where all that unmarked FCI resides on your network and then certifying its protection against the CMMC framework, that has created a substantial logistical pain point, particularly for smaller contractors who just don't have dedicated compliance staff.
And the practical implication of this increased cost of compliance is what? Are we actually seeing businesses choose to exit the defense industrial base?
We are. We are seeing small businesses decide to exit the DoD market entirely rather than incur the time and the cost that's associated with achieving CMMC Level 2 certification, which often involves hiring expensive third-party assessors.
Which raises some pretty important questions.
It does. It raises questions about the depth and breadth of the defense industrial base supply chain. I mean, if they are exiting now, were they adequately meeting the existing DFARS requirements to protect CUI before CMMC? The compliance cost is simply raising the table stakes beyond what many smaller players are willing or able to bear.
And in coupled with this new compliance push, the enforcement arm of the Justice Department is clearly visible, targeting fraud related to poor security.
Absolutely. Enforcement is ramping up aggressively under DOJ's Civil Cyber Fraud Initiative. We saw at least 6 or 7 public settlement announcements in 2025 alone, heavily focused on the defense industrial base.
What are they targeting specifically?
They're targeting issues like failure of basic safeguarding controls and, a big one, the use of unauthorized cloud service providers. The federal government is very adamant about enforcement, and they're using the False Claims Act to recover funds lost due to poor cyber hygiene.
So looking ahead to 2026, where will that enforcement focus shift next?
The experts we looked at, like Townsend Bourne, they all agree. Expect enforcement to really ramp up in 2026, especially regarding cloud compliance. The Federal Authorization Program for Cloud Services, known as FedRAMP, has been going through massive changes.
And we're already seeing indictment.
This week alone, we saw an indictment announced by the DOJ against an individual for fraud relating to the security of a cloud environment. This signals that cloud compliance will be a major focus area. Contractors can no longer just check boxes. They need documented evidence and dedicated staff to support a reasonable approach to data security.
So on the one hand, we have this relentless, technologically aggressive focus on kinetic power and AI supremacy. On the other hand, let's turn to the machinery that's supposed to support this entire federal enterprise, the workforce and management systems, which seem to be in a state of, well, self-induced crisis.
The contrast is truly stark. We're moving from massive future defense spending to a catastrophic breakdown in the basic functions of the federal HR system, specifically at the Office of Personnel Management, or OPM.
Let's look at the OPM retirement processing crisis, which really came to a head on December 22nd. House Democrats sent a very sharp letter to OPM Director Scott Cooper concerning the retirement influx spurred by the administration's Deferred Resignation Program, or DRP.
The DRP was intended to incentivize early exits for certain senior personnel, but it created a massive, and I should say, entirely foreseeable wave of retirements.
And the scale of the backlog is?
It's shocking. OPM received nearly 44,000 retirement applications in October and November combined. Now, to put that in context for you, that is more than triple the volume OPM saw in 2024 during the same 2 months. This influx has completely overwhelmed the agency HR offices and payroll providers before the cases even reach OPM for final processing.
So if there are 44,000 people stuck in this backlog, what is the actual human impact on their lives? I mean, are we talking about retirees unable to pay mortgages or access immediate health care?
That is precisely the crisis. These are retiring federal employees, people who dedicated decades to public service, and they are now trapped in what the letter calls administrative and financial limbo.
Yeah.
This means they're receiving little or no annuity payments, waiting months for the final calculation, facing prolonged delays, and getting very limited communication.
And the politics of this?
Democrats characterize this as a foreseeable and avoidable administrative failure, arguing the administration prioritized a purge of the federal civil service over government efficiency.
OPM did attempt some modernization with the online retirement application, the ORA. Why is that not enough to handle this volume?
The ORA is indeed modern. It handles about 1/3 of incoming applications digitally, which is progress. However, the system's deficiency is really exacerbated by simultaneous staffing cuts. Lower HR staffing levels across agencies mean employees can't get the personalized help they need to fix errors on their initial applications or even get status updates. So the applications that do reach OPM are often flawed and require manual intervention, which just grinds the entire system to a halt. And the crisis isn't over. A second wave of applications is expected imminently, which will further flood the system in the coming months.
It's a classic internal structural failure that demands a fundamental overhaul. In response, the administration made a surprising personnel move, hiring a noted critic of its own consolidation strategy.
That's right. OPM hired the former State Department CTO, Don Bauer, who famously called OPM's consolidation plan madness, as the new Deputy Associate Director for WSDC.
Okay, we need to define that acronym. What is WSDC and what is Bauer's critical mission?
WSDC is the Workforce Services and Data Consolidation Division. Bauer is now tasked with leading the HR line of business and the Quality Service Management Office, or QSMO. His mission is immense: to consolidate and modernize 119 disparate HR systems across the entire government by September 2027.
119 systems.
It is one of the largest enterprise IT modernization projects in the federal space. OPM plans to award the contract in January, with core system implementation expected by the end of April. Bauer, who experienced both the highs and lows of HR systems at State and DHS, he views this challenge as a generational opportunity. He stated he refused to be solely part of those who point out problems but do little in helping to solve them.
The philosophy driving this necessary HR and IT modernization comes into sharper focus when we look at the insights shared by former IRS CFO Teresa Hunter on December 22nd. She stresses that modernization is fundamentally about questioning your processes before you automate them.
Her commentary provides the essential operational blueprint for how Bauer has to succeed. Hunter emphasizes that true modernization requires resisting that urge to just put new technology on top of bad processes.
Right.
Because speeding up a task that serves no purpose only cements inefficiency. Her key principles are question efficiency, collaborate relentlessly, and lead with strategy.
Let's use her IRS examples to bring this to life for our listener. They're pretty powerful.
She points to three stunning examples of process elimination and optimization. First, the IRS found that manual depreciation reconciliation, where agents would manually compare records to automated systems, was rarely different. Yeah. So they simply eliminated the redundant step, saving countless hours.
Simple but effective. What's the second one?
Second, by analyzing different approaches and standardizing the best deposit and refund processes across multiple campuses, they reduced the time to process deposits and refunds by a dramatic 80%. That saved an estimated 1,300 labor hours annually and lowered the error rate to below 1%.
And even with AI, the focus remains on refining the process first.
Precisely. They use large language models, or LLMs, for specialized tasks, specifically lease classification. This reduced the processing time by 97% while ensuring compliance with Federal Financial Accounting Standards 54. They also successfully deployed LLMs for travel-related questions, streamlining guidance. Hunter stresses that real change requires the CFO, CIO, and HR leaders to be in absolute lockstep to break the cycle of pilot purgatory and deliver real, measurable results in months, not years.
Moving from the modernization plan to the immediate reality for military personnel, we saw significant changes to compensation announced on December 22nd, the Continental U.S. Cost of Living Allowance rates.
The Defense Department updated its 2026 CONUS-COLA rates. Now, this is a taxable allowance, and it's intended to offset costs for service members who are stationed in high-cost areas, specifically where non-housing living costs are at least 7% higher than the national average.
The immediate reaction seemed to focus on the cuts, which were pretty significant in some key areas.
They were substantial. COLA eligibility was lost entirely in 21 counties, including all the non-metropolitan counties in California and New York. They were deemed to have living costs below the new threshold. Critically, 9 military housing areas lost COLA completely.
Which ones?
Major population centers like Boston, Massachusetts, and the large California areas of San Luis Obispo, San Bernardino, and Riverside. The rate for New York City itself was nearly halved, dropping significantly from 8% down to 4%.
But the total fiscal impact suggests the cuts were offset by increases elsewhere, dramatically increasing in the number of beneficiaries overall.
That's the key fiscal shift. The total COLA cost in 2026 is projected at $99 million, benefiting roughly 127,000 service members nationwide.
And how does that compare to 2025?
It's nearly double the amount and double the number of recipients. In 2025, only about 61,000 service members received a total of $51 million. Seattle, for instance, saw the largest individual increase. It jumped from no COLA eligibility in 2025 to a 5% rate in 2026, which reflects the skyrocketing local costs there. Other West Coast areas like Oakland and San Francisco also saw notable increases.
One final point on workforce structure, we also saw the administration leverage the holidays for operational needs, mandating two key agencies remain open despite the presidential grant of December 24th and 26th off for most employees.
That's right. The Social Security Administration, SSA, and the IRS will stay open, citing public need. SSA Commissioner Frank Bisignano, who also interestingly serves as the chief executive officer of the IRS, told employees the SSA would keep field offices and phone lines open from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. on those days.
So not a full day.
Not a full day, and processing centers would be staffed virtually. The IRS customer service lines will be closed, but cases will still be worked remotely.
This is highly unusual, and it suggests an urgent administrative pressure point.
It is nowhere near normal for the SSA to remain open during presidential holidays. Bisignano justified the decision by saying it was necessary, quote, to serve the nearly 75 million seniors, disabled Americans, and most vulnerable who rely on us every day. Both agencies are seeking volunteers for holiday pay to staff these functions. And this move, it just highlights the deep operational strain within the federal workforce, even as SSA is simultaneously planning to cut its field office visits in half next year due to resource constraints.
Now, for the federal professionals planning their financial futures, we saw critical, immediate changes to retirement planning for high earners that will start in 2026. This ties directly back to that compensation structure we were just discussing.
This is critical knowledge for federal professionals planning for retirement, and it hits their take-home pay now. The major change arrives January 1st, 2026, with the Roth-only catch-up rule.
Walk us through that Roth shift specifically for, say, a typical GS-14 or GS-15 who's listening in.
Okay, so if you are age 50 or older and your W-2 wages in the prior year, that's 2025, exceeded $145,000, you are barred from making traditional pre-tax catch-up contributions starting January 1, 2026.
So all catch-up has to be Roth.
Exactly. Your catch-up contributions, which are $7,500 in 2026, must go exclusively into the Roth TSP, which is after tax. This impacts a very large cohort of high-earning GS-13s, pretty much all GS-14s, GS-15s, and SES employees.
So the immediate impact is a reduced take-home paycheck because you're now paying taxes on that $7,500 contribution now, not later.
That's it. For someone in the 24% tax bracket who's putting in the full $7,500 catch-up, that translates to approximately $1,800 more in federal taxes owed for that year. It significantly accelerates tax planning for pre-retirees. However, the long-term benefit remains. The money grows tax-free and is withdrawn tax-free in retirement.
And this change makes Roth conversions even more strategic than they were before for pre-retirees.
They become absolutely crucial for what's called tax smoothing. Financial experts are stressing that this strategy moving money from a traditional TSP or IRA into a Roth IRA is vital, especially for federal retirees who often stack three large taxable income streams in retirement.
Their pension, Social Security, and TSP.
Right. Their FERS, or CSRS pension, their Social Security, and their traditional TSP distributions. The key is coordinating these conversions early to manage your tax brackets effectively, which can prevent you from being pushed into unexpected higher tax brackets later in retirement.
Moving from the internal workings of the federal machine to the constitutional boundaries of federal power, let's discuss the Justice Department's highly aggressive legal strategy, what you've called the litigation blitzkrieg, which is aimed at asserting maximal federal supremacy.
That is the core theme. On December 22nd, the DOJ launched these coordinated legal assaults that target state-level autonomy in areas the administration prioritizes most, immigration and firearms. This is the legal arm of the unitary executive theory in action.
The lead case is United States v. Illinois, challenging two specific state sanctuary laws designed to protect Illinois residents from federal enforcement overreach.
Let's tackle the first contested law, the Illinois Bivens Act. Now, for the learner, the federal Bivens doctrine is essentially the ability to sue a federal officer personally for constitutional violations.
And the Supreme Court has limited that ability.
Severely restricted it.
Yeah.
So Illinois essentially recreated that right at the state level, allowing victims of federal misconduct to sue agents in state court and stripping them of qualified immunity. The DOJ argues this violates the Supremacy Clause. They're claiming a state cannot regulate or chill the enforcement of federal law by imposing liability on federal officers.
And the second contested law in that Illinois case.
That's the Court Access, Safety, and Participation Act. It prohibits ICE arrests near or en route to courthouses. It's essentially designed to ensure immigrants can access justice without fear of immediate detention. The DOJ argues this obstructs federal law enforcement operations and interferes with the sovereign right of the federal government to enforce immigration statutes.
And the reaction from Illinois.
Governor Pritzker's immediate response was to characterize the lawsuit as an authoritarian attempt to terrorize Illinois communities. It's signaling a major constitutional showdown ahead regarding the limits of state sanctuary powers.
Simultaneously, the DOJ filed United States v. District of Columbia, focusing on Second Amendment rights.
Right. This suit challenges DC's ban on semi-automatic firearms, specifically the AR-15. The strategy is to utilize the Supreme Court's Heller and Bruin precedents, arguing the ban infringes on the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms that are in common use.
And the strategic goal isn't just about DC.
No. The clear strategic intent here is to establish a nationwide precedent that would invalidate similar bans across the country. They're particularly targeting states like New York and California, and it fulfills a key commitment to gun rights advocates.
This assertive move toward the unitary executive model is nowhere clearer than in immigration enforcement. Let's circle back to DHS's aggressive actions in this space.
On December 22nd, DHS announced a dramatic temporary expansion of its voluntary departure protocols. They're calling it the holiday stipend.
And what does that entail?
They tripled the financial incentive to $3,000 for anyone who agrees to voluntary departure via the CBP Home app before December 31st.
But the seemingly generous offer is being framed by critics as a self-deportation trap. How does the technology weaponize this offer?
That is the core of the criticism. To qualify for the stipend, individuals must submit an intent to depart through the CBP Home app. And critically, that requires biometric registration and current geolocation.
So it creates a list.
Immigration advocates warn this creates a self-identification registry of everyone who took the money but then failed to depart. Secretary Noem confirmed the administration's intent, stating if they don't depart, we will fine them, we will arrest them. The app data will be explicitly weaponized for a mass enforcement surge that's set to begin on January 1st, 2026.
However, the federal judiciary seems to be actively pushing back against this acceleration and centralization of enforcement power.
In what's a major setback for the mass detention strategy, a California federal court in Maldonado Bautista v. DHS affirmed nationwide class eligibility for bond hearings.
And why is that so significant?
The administration's policy was to deny bond hearings to broad categories of detained immigrants, which effectively mandates indefinite detention. This ruling threatens to gridlock the system, as DHS simply lacks the physical capacity to detain millions indefinitely without the ability to deny bond and release people through the court process.
And we saw an even more dramatic act of judicial defiance in Maryland, demonstrating this growing constitutional crisis between the executive and judicial branches.
U.S. District Judge Paula Sheenis ordered the release of a detainee, Kilmer Abrego Garcia, and she cited the executive branch's stonewalling and judicial defiance, demonstrating the deepening crisis. She went even further.
Oh, so?
She kept a temporary order in place, prohibiting his re-detention in the middle of the night while his lawyers explore legal residency pathways. This is a clear indicator of courts becoming increasingly aggressive in response to what they see as executive noncompliance and delays.
We also saw the Supreme Court issue a technical but important decision siding with immigration judges.
Yes, on December 22nd, the Supreme Court rebuffed the administration. It allowed immigration judges to challenge restrictions on their public speech outside of the federal employee complaint system.
Which matters because...
Well, given the administration's crackdown and the firing of dozens of immigration judges deemed too lenient, this ruling raises immediate questions about the fairness of the Trump-appointed complaint system officials. It also raises the question of whether other federal workers will now use federal court to challenge firings instead of relying on what could be a biased internal system.
Finally, let's look at Congress. While largely recessed, they concluded a busy period of confirmations and are currently setting the stage for budget battles aimed at stemming these staff cuts.
Before leaving, the Senate confirmed 97 appointees, bringing the total in the second term to 417. This included crucial tech and defense officials who will drive that technocratic state agenda we talked about.
Who are the key names?
Ethan Klein was confirmed as USCTO at OSTP, and he's tasked with coordinating national policy on AI, quantum, and nuclear energy. And Kirsten Davies was confirmed as DOD CIO. She's emphasizing that great change is needed in the defense IT enterprise to meet the speed of modern threats.
We also saw key leadership put in place for massive infrastructure and healthcare overhauls, directly addressing some of the internal crises we discussed earlier.
That's right. Edward Forst was confirmed as GSA's first permanent head under this administration, and he's tasked immediately with tackling the massive federal real estate issue. The maintenance backlog on GSA properties has doubled since 2017, reaching a staggering $340
billion. $340
billion. Forrest will lead the effort to right-size the portfolio, and he noted that 25% of GSA's own headquarters is currently uninhabitable due to deferred maintenance. In healthcare, John Bartram was confirmed as Undersecretary for Health. He'll oversee a Veterans Health Administration, or VHA, reorganization that's expected to take 18 to 24 months. It's aimed at eliminating redundancies following the shedding of over 30,000 staff positions through attrition in fiscal year 2025.
Shifting to the appropriations battle, the deadline for funding most federal agencies is January 30th, and appropriators reached a top-line funding agreement below continuing resolution levels on December 22nd. This signals belt tightening, but Congress is specifically pushing back against staffing cuts in critical Homeland Security agencies.
This is the congressional resistance to the executive purge finally hitting the appropriations process. The Senate Appropriations Draft FY26 bill pushed back hard against cuts targeted at FEMA and CISA.
What kind of cuts are we talking about?
FEMA has lost approximately 2,500 staff since the spring, and the administration wants to shift more of its responsibilities to state governments. CISA, the agency responsible for civilian cybersecurity, has lost a third of its workforce. That's roughly 1,000 staff through departures and terminations.
So what specific actions did the Senate draft bill take to mitigate these cuts and force the executive branch to maintain its current workforce?
The draft bill includes $40 million for FEMA, specifically to hire staff for critical regional operations. And it directs the agency to maintain a workforce consistent with its funding to ensure mission continuity. It specifically bans reductions that would prevent timely guidance or support to grantees.
And for CISA?
For CISA, the draft provides $2.8 billion, explicitly rejecting the administration's proposed $500 billion cut. It also rejects proposed cuts to the National Risk Management Center. The bill directs CISA to maintain its workforce levels, keep no fewer than 10 regional field offices, and ensure there's at least one cybersecurity advisor per state. This is Congress using the power of the purse to directly control the size and scope of the executive branch workforce, regardless of the administration's desire for attrition.
This has been an exhaustive look at what happened in a single hyperactive day. When we synthesize these four theaters, defense transformation, technocratic regulation, workforce crisis, and constitutional litigation, what is the central conclusion we deliver to the listener?
The central synthesis is that December 22nd marked the full, explicit realization of the unitary executive theory. That theory is the belief that the president has supreme authority over the entire executive branch, and we see it executed in every single one of these theaters.
Give us the examples.
Centralization of power, seen in the DOJ attacking state sanctuary laws via the Supremacy Clause. Aggressive militarization, evidenced by the Department of War and the nuclear-capable Trump-class battleship. And pervasive deregulation, like the FTC's shift on AI and the DOI's move against wind energy, all aimed at achieving technological and industrial supremacy. The executive branch is using every lever legal, military, and regulatory to assert maximal federal authority over state and regulatory autonomy.
And the key tension point, the central paradox in all of this, is where that centralized power meets the domestic federal machinery that's designed to implement it.
Absolutely. The crisis is internal. The massive accelerated investments in defense hardware and AI technology contrast so sharply with the desperate crisis in the foundational human capital systems at home.
So it's a house divided against itself.
In a way, yes. We have the military focused on hypersonic weapons and laser defense, while OPM is literally drowning in 44,000 unprocessable retirement applications. This internal management failure is the friction point that's slowing down the entire aggressive project, and it poses a far greater risk to long-term efficiency than any external geopolitical challenge.
It brings us to our final provocative thought for you to consider. The simultaneous announcement of the Golden Fleet, representing a multi-decade, overwhelming investment in physical and technological might, and the desperate, belated hiring of Don Bauer to fix OPM's broken 119 system HR apparatus highlights the administration's dual vision for government. Which strategic realignment, the overwhelming physical and technological might abroad represented by the battleship, or the critical recognition of the crisis in the foundational human capital systems at home, represented by the massive HR system overhaul, will prove more difficult to achieve by 2028.
I suspect that internal structural failure is far harder to fix than building a giant ship. It always comes down to people and process, which are messy.
Indeed. Thank you for diving deep with us today.
It's a pleasure.
You've been listening to The Deep Dive. We'll be back soon with another look inside the complex machinery of government.